So here we go on a real quick trip this morning, but this is some background material and something we want to really try to remember, particularly as we're looking now at these few chapters, Matthew 23, 24, and 25. Now, we've been looking then in those three chapters at pages 191 through 204. That's a lot of material, and that's the problem. We really need to be able to remember all three of those chapters. And it's worse than that because there's related material that is scattered throughout all four of the Gospels that really also needs to be thrown into this hopper. So what this is typically referred to is the Olivet Discourse, because chapters 24 and 25 were taking place with Jesus speaking to the apostles on this Mount of Olives. This is my all-time favorite artist illustration, I think, of the Mount of Olives, as they were quite literally and really with that same angle looking down on the city of Jerusalem. Love this picture. Shows you the wall quite well. Shows you the Pool of Bethesda, which has five porticos, you know, four on the outside and one crossing. Shows you the Fortress of Antonia. You can see the temple itself. All of this you look down upon from the Mount of Olives. Jesus has come out of this temple area. He's been in these courtyards right here. Actually, it appears in chapters 21 and 22, and certainly 23 as well. Then he crosses the Kidron Valley, comes up here to talk to his disciples for chapters 24 and 25. This material, brethren, is extremely involved. That's a lot of verses. And the problem in studying it, the reason so often that we get derailed, and I was for years and years and years, is that I couldn't keep it all in my head all at once. I'd look at a section, and I'd go to, you know, the next day and study the next few verses or chapter. And so this morning, that's why I'm warning you, we're going to try to look at really a whole lot of material to see if we can't just get everything together like that. So I had said that we were going to start on page 200 there and change my mind after I made this particular slide. So actually, I'd like to have everybody to come back now to page 196. We're going to look at 196. And as we're doing this, here's another overarching thought for you. As we're studying, you want to be keeping this context, you know, in mind at all times. And the chief concern, as we think about the context in which all this material is presented, is this question now. Did Jesus ever change the subject? Is there a transition that accounts for now 1,987 years? Okay, from the generation in which he presented this material, he starts off certainly talking about events that will take place in the lifetime of the people that he's talking to. The big question is, did he ever jump out of that ship and start talking about something else? If so, where did that transition take place? Where did Jesus go from a discussion, which everybody accepts, of the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, only 40 years ahead, that generation, where did he shift gears and go to talk about a judgment that has not yet happened? So 1,987 years ago, Jesus was preaching in one time to one set of people. He never moved and never took a breath. Was he talking about two different things that now have over 1,900 years, nearly 2,000 between them? Keep asking yourself that. And what I hope we've established, both in this morning's class as well on the Wednesday night class, where we happen, just coincidentally, to have some overlap. We looked at this material over the last couple of weeks in the Wednesday night class, too. There is absolutely no transition in Matthew chapters 23 or 24. Certainly in those two chapters, Jesus never changed the subject. He didn't go from a judgment on Jerusalem that you could escape in 70 AD to a global judgment that nobody can escape, which hasn't happened yet. We're still waiting for it. There's no transition in 23 and 24. But a great many people, in and among the Lord's people, in fact, not just out in the denominational world, do think that Matthew 25, which we're going to finish this morning, has a transition. Somewhere in there, finally, Jesus does change the subject. Those same venue, same people, uninterrupted presentation, based on the two questions the apostles asked. A lot of people think at 25, he skipped ahead 19 centuries. So we just want to keep that in mind. Is that what we're seeing anywhere in this material? So, as I said, I now want to start on page 197. Got this slide right, didn't get the other one. But what we're going to do is actually glance at page 196 if you have the Harmony. And if you don't have the Harmony, you really need one this morning. Who in here does not have a copy of this book? Okay. So this will give you, of course, of the Harmony. It's having all the Gospels arranged on a single page and being able to compare. So let's just, everybody, just kind of glance at page 196. Matthew 24 talks about the Olivet discourse. Mark 13 records this discourse. Luke 21 talks about it as well. And please note that as you're looking at all of this, on this page, what Jesus is talking about is events that are going to happen to the people that he's talking to. For instance, just take the last thing in Matthew's column on page 196, verses 8 and 9 there of Matthew 24. All these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation. They will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. Coming to the top of 197 now, and at that time, many will fall away and will deliver up one another and hate one another. And then continuing with Matthew 24:11, and many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. The end's going to come when, and that was one of the two questions the disciples asked back in verse 3, when shall these things be, that not one stone will be left upon another? Well, the when answer is when the gospel's been preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations. Raise your hand if you have on the page the list of scriptures I gave you which show that that was fulfilled by 62 A.D. Okay, it's only about half, so here you go. Right in the Mark column, since you got blank space, right underneath there where it says, but the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved, or right immediately adjacent to Matthew 24:14, put Romans 1:8. Romans 1:8, and also in the Roman letter, chapter 10, verse 18. Romans 1:8 and 10:18. Then also right there, Colossians chapter 1, verses 6 and 23. Actually, you can get a little before and after those verses, but those are the ones that are really at the heart of it. Colossians 1, 6 and 23. And then again, in Acts 2, verses 5 through 11. Those passages say that that gospel was preached in all of the very word that's used there for world in Matthew 24:14 by 62 A.D. when Paul was writing the Colossian letter. Now, that's the when answer. And then, in Matthew 24:15, the very bottom left on page 197, the next verse answers the what question. It said, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? It's only one question. It's a compound statement. It's got the word and in it, but there's only one question. What will be the sign? Sign is singular. What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? His coming is to end the age. We're talking about the age where the temple is still standing, Moses' law is being practiced, the sacrifices are being offered, the priesthood is officiating, Levitical priesthood. That's what the apostles asked about. So in verse 15, what question is answered? Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, turn the page. Now we're on 198, Matthew 24:16. Then Then when you see, in verse 15, the abomination of desolation, when you see that, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who's on the housetop not go down and get things out that are in his house. Let him who's in the field not turn back to get his cloak. Woe to those who are with child and those who nurse babes in those days. Pray your flight may not be in the winter on a Sabbath. For then there'll be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. So for the sake of God's people, those days will be cut short. People will survive, and you can survive this judgment by getting out of Jerusalem. Run away. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who's on the housetop not turn back to get his clothes. Hope you're not nursing a babe, fleeing in the winter on a Sabbath. There's going to be great tribulation, but those days will be cut short. Life will be saved. An escapable physical judgment. And he's telling them what to do to save their lives, not to save their souls. They're asking about a cataclysm that will physically take place in their lifetimes. If you want to escape that and not be killed, not be taken captive, then run out of Jerusalem, get out of Judea, go to the hills, which they did, a city called Pella. Uninspired writers report exactly what the Christians did. Now, please note, and brethren, it's just unfortunate. I have no idea how it happened, you know, but I would just like to hit the editors of this book over the head with their own book, okay? Because look at verse, page 198, top right, Luke says something on this exact same occasion. He records something Jesus said that Matthew and Mark didn't. But that little verse 20 there would have been so much better back on 197 in the blank space at the bottom of Luke's column. Because there on 197 at the bottom, when Jesus said in Matthew 24 and 15, when you see the abomination of desolation which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then you're in Judea, flee to the mountains, Luke said, and it should have been right there, they should have pulled that verse 20 up so it would match these, but you got to turn the page to look now on 198 in the right-hand top. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is 2,000 years away. No, you're used to my little artifice there, you know, to call your attention. No, he said it's near, it's at hand, it's not far away at all. It's not 19 millenniums away. What is the abomination of desolation? It is the encircling of Jerusalem by the Roman armies, which did take place actually in 66 AD, and then the Christians fled, and a 3.5-year siege began, which finally ended in the death of most of the Jews in Jerusalem, in the captivity of all the rest of the Jews that were in Jerusalem, and the tearing down of the temple. It was left desolate, not one stone left on another. I have seen some of the stones from that Temple Mount. They are still lying in a jumbled pile at the bottom of what is called the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall. And so that desolation took place. Now, as you skip then to the very bottom of page 198 in Matthew's column, then if anyone says to you, behold, here's the Christ or there's the Christ, don't believe them, false prophets will arise. All of that is about not being misled by false prophets. So we come now to Matthew 24, 29 on page 199. But immediately, that is immediately, that's immediately, that would be immediate with an L-Y on the end. Okay? Immediately after the tribulation of those days. Immediately after you have to flee your homes and businesses to get out of Jerusalem. Immediately after you've saved your life by going over to the city of Pella. Immediately after you've escaped, you know, the encircling of Jerusalem by the Roman armies. When you see them coming, get out of town. And then immediately after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall. Please read Ezekiel 13. Isaiah 13 that's inserted into the text there, where the same terminology used is about a physical invasion in Babylon. Ezekiel 32 does the same thing. Joel does the same thing. It is well known to the Jews that that terminology does not refer to planets, moons, and suns. It refers to a cataclysm. Like we say, December 7th, 1941 was a dark day in our history. It wasn't. It was a beautiful sunshiny day. But it was a dark day in history. The Jews were just more florid. The prophets would say, no sun, no moon, no stars. If there's no sun or moon or stars, how dark a day is it? It's a pretty dark day. That's all they're doing. Studied all of that at great length. I know it's frustrating. I'm just reviewing right now. But all those expressions are used of physical judgments on nations by invading armies repeatedly in the Old Testament. None of those are talking about stuff that's happening up in the cosmos in all those contexts. Then it says, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear. And it will not appear in the sky. It's the sign that the Son of Man is in heaven. Again, long story, sky and heaven, the Greek word ouranos is only one word, be translated either way. It can also be translated, the sign that he's in heaven will appear. And I think that's what this is about, proving that Jesus still lives. Then it says, the tribes of the earth, you got from last week's lesson a whole lot of verses where earth is poorly translated. In Matthew's gospel, it's usually translated land, land of Israel, land of Naphtali, the land of Zebulun, should have been land here. It's the tribes of the land, the tribes of Israel. Turning to page 200, will mourn. And then they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Again, coming on the clouds is a symbol of judgment used repeatedly in the Old Testament. God doesn't ride on fluffy white piles of condensation in the sky. It's an expression that means you can't stop him. He'll do what he's going to do. But note, it's a judgment. Note that at the end of verse 30, very top of page 200, left-hand column, then it's with power and it's with great glory. And note in verse 31, he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather his elect together from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Which is a way of saying, when the judgment comes, the king will be judging in glory, and his angels are going to be a part of this. Now, finally to get down to where we ended last week with verses 32 through 34. If you had any doubt about anything that I have said, read now 32 through 34. Without taking a breath, Jesus adds, now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer's a couple of millenniums away. Well, you know it's nearer. Even so, you too, the people he's talking to, when you see, they're the ones that pointed at the temple, and he said, do you see all these things? Not one stone will be left upon another. They asked the question. Even so, you too, when you see all, not some, not a few, not most, not a bunch, all of these things, everything he has said in the preceding 32 verses, when you see all these things, recognize that he is what? Near. That he is at the door. And if you couldn't understand those two expressions, 34 says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until how many of these things take place? All of them. So if you don't get the stars falling and you don't understand all this and you haven't read Isaiah or Ezekiel, none of that even matters. One thing you know for sure, in this verse 34, you are told that it all has to happen to the people and in the generation in which those folks are living, or Jesus is a false prophet. He is not the Son of God because his prophecy failed. Now, either all these things take place in that generation, or Jesus is not the Son of God. Those are your only two choices. And we have all kinds of testimony in the Bible and out that every one of those things did take place in that generation. Heaven and earth, the continual will pass away, but my word shall not pass away. He's not saying that he's talking about heaven and earth passing away. He is saying the prophecy that these things would take place in all these things would take place in this generation is more certain than the continuing existence of the heavens and the earth. 36. But of that day, the only day, the same day, the word day has been used repeatedly in these preceding 35 verses. The day they asked about and the hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, not even the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man. They asked about the coming of the Son of Man in verse 3. Jesus has been telling them about the coming of the Son of Man ever since. The coming of the Son of Man in that generation, when the Roman armies will surround the city, when the abomination of desolation comes, when you are to flee out of that city and that country to save your life. He says there that nobody knows the day or the hour. They only know the generation, but not the day or the hour. So, in 37, the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. As in those days, which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. They did not understand that the flood came, until the flood came, took them all away. So shall the what? The coming of the Son of Man. The only question that is involved here is when is the Son of Man coming and what will be the sign when he comes? So then, this coming will be like these days of Noah. 40. There will be two men in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken, one will be left. Now, get your pencil out. There, at the end of verse 41, in that blank space above the little footnotes there, in that space write, C, Luke, Gospel of Luke, chapter 17, verses 23 through 37, where on an entirely different occasion, page 162 in the harmony. That's page 162 in the harmony. You go there and you look, and you have all these same things being preached by Jesus a year or more earlier to the event we're now talking about. This is another time when Jesus talked about what would happen in that generation. And note that when you look at Luke 17 on page 162, these various aspects of what he's talking about, verse after verse, are rearranged in Luke 17. So that stuff in Matthew that comes after the verse 34, which says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away till all these things take place," stuff that appears in Matthew after that generation time limitation, in Luke's account in chapter 17, is rearranged and grouped with stuff that came before Matthew 24:34's declaration of when these things will come to pass. Just to say, all these things, no matter which side of verse 34 they're on, are talking about the same day, the same time frame, the same escapable judgment, the same time when Jerusalem will fall and the temple will be destroyed. So, now come down, everybody, we'll get into new material, at verse 42 in page 201. What did I do here? Yeah, okay, there we go. Okay, so, watch what happens, and keep asking yourself, is there a break? Is there a transition? Does he change horses in midstream? Does he say something that tells me that 1900 years are going to go by? Is there a difference in the material, or is it uninterrupted about the same day? Now, if you know takers, we are now going to get five parables, and they all say exactly the same thing. So if there's a transition in any of these parables, it'll be awful hard to find because they all teach exactly the same thing, which is to be alert. So on page 197, we have the man on a journey there in the center column of Mark chapter 13, verse 33. Take heed. Keep on the alert. For you don't know when the appointed time is. It's like a man away on a journey who, upon leaving his house and putting his slaves in charge, assigned to each one his task, also commanded the doorkeeper to stay on the alert. Therefore, be on the alert. For you do not know when the master of the house is coming, whether in the evening, at midnight, at cock crowing, or in the morning. Turn the page, center of 202. Lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all. Be what? On the alert. Be on the alert. So parable number one, Mark 13:33. Actually, I guess your 37 might be a better way to put it. It's about the man on the journey. What do you do? Be alert. Now, if you turn back to 201 just for a second, look at Matthew 24, verse 42, last verse, left-hand column, page 201. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. Turn the page, 202, we've already read Mark's column, look at Matthew 24, 43. Parable number two. Now, number one is only recorded by Mark. Number two is recorded by Matthew, verse 43. Be sure of this. If the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been, what? On the alert. He would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too. For the Son of Man, the expression that's been used about Jesus throughout this, is coming. The question we're wondering about, when is the Son of Man coming? At an hour, verse 44, when you do not think. Second parable, just like the first one, this defeating of the thief in Matthew 24, 42 through 44 says, be alert and be ready. Now, verses 45 through 50 is the parable of the faithful slave, and only Matthew records this material. 45, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he'll put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master's not coming for a long time, and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves, and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when what? What did the previous two parables tell us about? You don't know the day or the hour. Come when he doesn't expect, and at an hour which he does not know. And Matthew 24 ends with verse 51, shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and gnashing of teeth. By the way, all those things physically took place during the 3.5-year siege and finally the fall of Jerusalem in 66 to 70 A.D. as well. So what do we have? Is there any transition? Study that. I did for years. I was desperate to find somewhere in this material where I could change the subject and skip over 1900 and some odd years and look to a future judgment of the whole planet that you can't escape by fleeing Judea. I can't find it. I had to give up and admit there is no transition in Matthew 24. So, stare at the page, brethren. There were no chapter headings when Jesus uttered these words. There were no chapter headings or verse numbers for 1,300 more years. Without taking a breath, Jesus continued in what we now look at as the first verse of a new chapter. And that leads people to start in that first verse thinking that it's got nothing to do with the preceding chapter, as if days had gone by and Jesus had left Jerusalem, gone back to Galilee or something. Where's the transition between the last verse of 24 and the first verse of 25? Can you see one? No, he says, then. They asked, when? And he's telling them, when the gospel's preached, then the end shall come. Run from Judea. Desolation's coming. Roman army surrounding Jerusalem. Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins. Took their lamps, went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 foolish, 5 prudent. Foolish took lamps, took no oil. Prudent took oil in flasks along with their lamps. While the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. Midnight there's a shout. Behold the bridegroom, come out to meet him. All the virgins rose, trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the prudent, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. Prudent answered, saying, no, it will not be enough for us and you too. Go instead to the dealers, buy some for yourselves. While they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came. Those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast. The door was shut. Later the other virgins came saying, Lord, Lord, open up for us. But he answered and said, truly I say to you, I do not know you. Now read verse 13 and tell me how very different it was from the preceding four parables. Not at all, is it? It says, be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. Now, brethren, I went through years of frustration and embarrassment now in my life thinking that transition took place, chapter 25, verse 1, and Jesus went off to shift gears and talk about the end of the world. And I had to come back. And I wanted the transition to be there. I had years of teaching invested in it. I had a paradigm about last things in my head. And finally, in 1987, I think it was, I finally had to just give it up. There is no transition there. Not anything remotely like a transition. It starts with then, that connects it to the same time frame we had before, the generation those people are standing in, and it ends with the same refrain in verse 13. Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day or the hour. So, look for the transition, brethren, at verse 14. See how dramatically in verse 14 Jesus changes the subject. He closes the door on one topic and he opens the door on another. Just plain as the nose on your face, right? Well, if you see it, I can't. No, what I see is union, conjunction. He says, for it is just like. He continues with another illustration, a fifth one. It's just like a man about to go out on a journey. Called his own slaves, entrusted his possessions to them. One he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, according to his own ability. Went on his journey. One who had received the 5 talents went and traded, gained 5 more talents. Same manner, the one who had received the 2 gained 2 more. He who received the 1 went away, dug in the ground, hid his master's money. And after a long time, the master of those slaves came, settled accounts. The one who had received the 5 came up, bought 5 more, and said, Master, you entrusted 5. See, I've gained 5 more. Master said, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful in a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things and enter into the joy of your master. The one also had received the 2 talents came up. Master, you entrusted me 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more talents. Master said, well done, good faithful slave. You were faithful in a few. Put you in charge of many. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also had received the 1 talent came up, said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed, and I was afraid. Went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, you wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him. Give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has shall more be given. He who had, and he shall have an abundance, but from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. And cast out the worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, brethren, an awful lot is made out of that outer darkness. People just saying, this is what it means. Without any grounds or basis whatsoever, they just speculate. This is what it means. Brethren, I think all it means is that in the parable, the guy got pitched out of the house. It's the parable. It's a judgment. He's not fit to be as the master's servant anymore. This doesn't say anything about, you know, eternity or final judgment, nothing. That's just a part of the parable to make the point that the man didn't serve his Lord properly. Now watch this. Here's where we're going to spend the next 10 minutes. Most of it anyway. Brethren, after these 5 talents at least, up through verse 30, where's the transition? Now, I submit to you, there absolutely is none. You can't find it because it isn't there. Jesus did not change the subject. But virtually the whole world thinks that because of the nature of verses 31 through 46, They do exactly the same thing here that they do back in Matthew 24, 32, and 33. They go, see, the sun, moon, and stars are going to go dark, and that's never happened. They haven't read Isaiah, they haven't read Ezekiel, they haven't read Joel, they don't know it's happened repeatedly in history, they don't know their Old Testament, so they just say, that's never happened because I assume that it means the actual planets will go physically dark. It doesn't. Now they're going to do the same thing here. They're going to say, well, look what it says. These things can't possibly happen in the first century. Therefore, they'll never find them in that passage because they've already decided that it's impossible. All I'm asking you to do this morning is to open your mind and say, well, is it possible that the sun, moon, and stars falling in that generation, all those things, is an Old Testament expression, those people would understand. It's not talking about actual planets, but about a cataclysm here on earth when the Roman armies come. Ask yourself, is it possible that verses 31 and 46 might be talking about the same thing? So first, in 31 through 34 of Matthew 25, in the middle of page 202, recorded only by Matthew, then the kingdom of heaven will be that's not it. It's the bottom of page 203. Sorry about that, whiplash. 203. But when the Son of Man comes in His glory. Now, I reviewed with you this morning that we've already seen that same phrasing prior to Matthew 24, 34, which says all these things will take place in this generation that He's talking to. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne. And all the nations will be gathered before Him. He'll separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He'll put the sheep on the right and the goats on the left. And then the king will say to those on the right, come, you who are blessed of my Father. Now remember, and it's very important, right in between Father and inherit, what Jesus means is, what you're supposed to believe is, 2,000 years will go by and we're not going to talk about the church on earth at all or the building of the kingdom. We're just going to skip all of that and we're going to take the phrase inherit the kingdom to mean go to heaven. That isn't what he said, but that's what we assume, and I did it for years to my shame. Brethren, what he said was the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And that's what we've been studying in our Sunday morning sermons. God's scheme of redemption and the coming of the kingdom on earth that was fulfilled in Acts chapter 2. We'll stop right there. So, where's the transition, though, brethren? Did verse 31 say, now I want to talk about something else? No, it said, but when the Son of Man comes and uses the same phrasing that we had in the previous material. Now look here. Here are these same verses again. We just read them. Now, this is exactly like Matthew, same gospel, 16. Now, here it is, photographed from page 118 in my particular harmony, the way I've highlighted it. Talked about this months ago. Now look, Matthew 16, the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of His Father with His angels and will then recompense every man according to his deeds. Sounds like a judgment, doesn't it? And then it says, truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in His what? Same kingdom we're talking about in Matthew 25, verse 31. Same kingdom. Now, brother, in Matthew 16, there's absolutely no doubt. Take Mark, chapter 8, 38. Whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And he was saying to them, truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death till they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. The kingdom of God is coming to the earth with power. Luke 9. Whoever is ashamed of me and my words. Of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels. But I say to you truthfully, there are some of those standing here who will not taste death till they see the kingdom of God. That is not going to heaven. It's you guys standing here, not physically dying, till I set up the kingdom that Matthew 25 is talking about on the earth. When I set up the spiritual kingdom, the Christian kingdom, upon my having replaced, Jesus is saying, the old kingdom of Moses' law and the Jews, and I'm going to prove that I've replaced Moses' law with Christianity, because in 70 AD, I'm going to tear that temple down, not one stone left on another, and it'll be impossible to practice that old religion ever again, and it's never been practiced to this day. So, brethren, it's the exact terminology that we have in Matthew 25 through 31. Only it was a year and a half ago, and it was in that generation he was talking about. Matthew 25, 34. Are we skipping the kingdom on earth in that verse? That's what I'm maintaining. The answer should be no. This is the fulfillment of all the prophets. It's about to happen. Jesus has to die for it to happen. And he's telling them about its coming very soon. In fact, in that generation. Now, I know I run short on time, but everybody have a look here at the criteria for this judgment. Think about it. Does the criteria stipulated for this judgment fit your idea, anybody else's, or the Bible's idea of what a final judgment will be like? How the world will be judged when the world will be no more? Is this the criteria? 35. I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, gave me drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. Naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me. And then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you a drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked or clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? The king will answer and say to them, watch this. Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Now I'm out of time, so I'm just going to tell you. What is the judgment's criteria? Pass or fail, based on how you treat Jesus' disciples. How you treat his brethren. If you've mistreated Jesus' brethren, you're going down. Now look at verse 41. It'll say on the left, depart from me, cursed ones, into the eternal fire. Well, I've got to be in the world then. Never happened. Which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. I was hungry, gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, gave me nothing to drink. I was strange, you didn't invite me in. Naked, you didn't clothe me. Sick and in prison, you didn't visit. Then they themselves also will answer and say, Lord, when do we see you hungry, thirsty, stranger, naked, sick in prison, and didn't do it? And he'll answer, truly I say to you, to the extent you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away, it's not specified when, into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Two different times he says, the only judgment's criteria, not whether you tell lies, it's not whether you've been faithful, worship the Lord on Sunday, believe in the resurrection. There's only one thing to do. How did you treat my brothers? And if you didn't treat them right, you're going down. Now, brethren, in the first century, in that generation, who did not treat the Lord's brethren properly? The Jews, who persecuted them to the death during those 40 years. Now then, watch this. But don't listen to that. Okay. Look at 41 and then 46. I'm going to show you Jude 7. But it's almost solely because people see eternal fire. And I know what that means, and it can't mean anything else. So, this has to be the end of the world. Case closed, I won't listen anymore. Really? You got a picture of what eternal fire is, and you won't give it up, and therefore, you have to rip this whole passage out of context where there is no transition, and skip 1900 years, still counting, to the end of the world. But what about this passage in Jude 7? Jude 7 says, Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality, went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing, that's an ongoing action, they are now undergoing what? It's a quote from Jude 7. Brethren, I've been twice to Israel. I've been all along to see the Dead Sea. I've swam in it. I've been on the Sodom and looked down out on it from a high vantage point. We all know Sodom and Gomorrah is down there somewhere. And twice I was able to stand on the side and go, well, there it is, because see, there's that eternal fire. You can see the smoke coming up. Right? No. Is that eternal fire burning on Sodom and Gomorrah right now? Well, yeah. Is there any smoke from it you can see? No. And one of the great scholarly debates among archaeologists, where is Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, brethren, if eternal fire means constantly ongoing, then it's been going on Sodom and Gomorrah for a long time, and it ought to be there still. But it isn't. Brethren, the consequences of the fire that fell from heaven are what? Eternal. But does the fire have to keep burning? No. Once you burn the house down, the consequences are forever. But does the fire keep burning? No. No. In a like manner, brethren, what he's talking about in Matthew 25 is not about the end of the world, no more sun, moon, and stars, and you're going to be tormented forever. In other words, brethren, there's no transition. And if there is no transition, then there is no subject change. And the only subject change is, when is the Lord going to come in glory with his holy angels to recompense everyone who mistreated the saints, the Christians of the first century in that generation, when all these things will take place? And then one day the eyes opened and I said, you know, I got to give up that old teaching about Jesus jumping ship, skipping 1900 years, and going to talk about a final judgment that hasn't happened yet, when he never did any such thing. I just didn't know it yet. And it took me years to figure it out. And by the way, I'm not the only one. An awful lot of people have done that, and so you may too. So, that's the last of my slides. I knew I'd run late, but there you go. So, come talk to me if you're really troubled by this, and, you know, certainly I can help you out as best I can.